About. We're going to be in Genesis 11 and 12 this morning. We're continuing our series of Bible events and characters, working our way through the story of the Bible. And talking about this morning the Tower of Babel and the call of Abram, and thinking about our lives and how they relate to those narratives. This time of the year is sports, and more sports. If you're like me, if you're mostly a football fan, not as much a Kentucky basketball fan, this is like the prime season. And then my Rangers made the playoffs. They're choking to death in the playoffs, but they made the playoffs. And so you've got the baseball playoffs, and you've got football, and more football. And you see the same thing every year. As this happens, you see some teams start to do really, really well, and all of a sudden, everyone is a fan. They call them bandwagon fans. And I've always kind of wondered, what's the appeal of that? Because, I grew up following certain teams, and I still follow those teams, thick or thin, whatever. But I see every year people who care nothing about sports suddenly become all excited, and the stadiums fill up, and they watch every game and all of that when usually they pay no attention. What's this bandwagon appeal? Do we feel the need to associate ourselves with the glory and honor of others? Do we do that so that we will feel personally some of their success? Or to have others connect the success of our team with us? Yeah, I remember years ago when Tampa Bay was horrible for year after year after year, their fans started wearing sacks over their heads in the stands, which was very funny. But you get it. I mean, when your team is doing horrible, do you wear their T-shirt? Do you wear their hat when they're doing really? Yes, Steve Hawley does. But when your team is doing really well, suddenly they start selling hats and T-shirts. People want to be seen as connected with that success. We're all naturally driven by the need to feel significant, to really be somebody. No matter how tall or short or wide or thin or extroverted or introverted, we want to feel significant, and we want to have others regard us as significant. I think about in our neighborhood, we go for walks in our neighborhood a lot, and it's packed with people and all kinds of things going on, which is kind of fun. One of the things that I noticed in the neighborhood, there's a correlation between the size of an engine and how loud it is. The smaller the engine, the louder it is. And so if motorcycle comes by, you have to cover your ears. If a small car goes by, it's blah, 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 blah. What is that? We want to be noticed. We want to be significant. We want to be seen. We want people to look at us, or at least some of us do. You may have noticed that some people buy jerseys with another person's name on the back, and the other person's name and number on the back of a jersey that they wear. And the more successful that player, the more popular his or her jersey. I guess we want to wear the player's name so that we can feel more personally connected to their success. Have people, when they see us, think that we're kind of connected to the success of that player in some special way. I think we'd all agree, however, that it'd be much better to have some people clamoring to own jerseys with our name and number on the back. To have a name that people look up to and admire. Achieving a good name is important to all of us. In our text this week, we find two very different ways to obtain a great name. It portrays two radically different ways of life, and we choose between them. All of us do. We may not know we have to make the choice, but we probably already have. And it's a choice that we make kind of on a daily basis. There's something that speaks to all of us here, regardless of our name. These events take place at a time when the world is in total chaos. Evil that cannot fix itself dominates everything. God's very good creation, as we've been reading, as we've been going through the story of Genesis, we see that God's very good creation has now been spoiled by human desires and ambitions. Adam and Eve's sin in the garden is followed by one story of crime and punishment after another. Murder, adultery, polygamy, all kinds of things going on that was not a part of God's plan. The very next thing that happens after Adam and Eve sin in the garden is their son Cain, their first son, murders their second son, Abel. And from that inauspicious beginning, sin spreads throughout the whole humanity. And so we noticed last week, the passage of Genesis 6, 5, and 6, the Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. That says some important things about God. It says he's vulnerable to our actions. It says that what we do affect him very personally. His heart was filled with pain. So God decides that he's just going to have to wash away the filth in the world and get a clean start with the only righteous man left on the face of the earth, Noah. Yet even after the flood, nothing really improves. Human society starts all over again after the flood. It becomes very clear very quickly that humans are going to defy God all over again. The first thing you know, Noah gets drunk. His children shame him. He curses some of his offspring. And then we have a movement to the plains of Shinar. God had made it clear in creation that he wanted humans to scatter across the whole earth. He said in Genesis 1:28, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Well, after the flood, Genesis 9, God repeats that command, fill the earth. But the humans refuse to follow God's plan. Like Adam and Eve, they reject God's vision in order to follow their own vision of what's best for their lives. So they clump together and they build a great city of their own with a great tower, the world's first skyscraper. And the express reason they say they want to do this, so that we will make a name for ourselves. They want to become great. They want to build a lasting reputation. They want to build something here in Shinar that is solid and stable and secure. They want to build something that 5,000 years later, people are still talking about. They want to build something impressive, something that future generations will gawk at in amazement. They want a sense of permanence, of lasting significance in this world. They want to build a great world of their own. Genesis tells how God came down to earth to see this city and tower. It's like it was too tiny and insignificant for him to even see from heaven. He had to come down to see the city and this tower. And he's not impressed. He knows that because of the evil in their hearts, the only great thing they will do is sin. They'll build nothing of real greatness. And because they refuse to fulfill his goodwill for them to scatter across the earth, he has to compel them to. So he mixes up their languages so they can't communicate with each other, which leads to a world like we know, a world where people are scattered all about, separated into little tribes and nations in competition and conflict with each other. And if you're hearing or reading this story in Genesis for the first time, can you imagine that? You're reading this story starting with the first page, the first word, and you're reading this narrative for the first time. You're starting to feel a great deal of tension by this point in the story, because it's becoming apparent by this point in the story that the human problem threatens God's entire creation, and there's no apparent way to fix it. When humans continually revert to the same sins for the same reasons, when they refuse God's will and build the Tower of Babel even after the flood, it's becoming apparent that this world will never be fixed through punishment. It's apparent, isn't it? You can ratchet up the punishment all you want to, but it will not solve the human problem. It will take something other than punishment and destruction to save the world. So what can God do if he isn't going to give up on these people and his creation? That's where the call of Abraham comes in. In stark contrast to the desire of the citizens of Shinar to make a name for themselves, God comes to Abram and offers to give him a great name. Now, at this point, there's nothing special about Abram. The only thing that distinguishes him and his wife Sarai is that they're cursed with infertility. They can't seem to have children together. And from the perspective of their time, because they cannot have children, they have no future. Their names will die with them. Within a couple of generations, even their graves will be forgotten. No stories will be told of them. Nobody will keep their memory alive. They will vanish from the earth, and it will be as if they never even existed. They have no name. Abraham's journey from Ur of the Chaldees to the land God called him to doesn't take place all at once. Abram first moves with his father Terah and his nephew Lot from Ur to Haran. Same culture, same language, not that big a stretch for them. He stays there until his father dies, and only then does he embrace the call of God and do something very scary. He leaves home, he leaves family and the protection of his own culture and area where he has connections and support. He leaves that and he goes to a distant place, a strange place. He becomes a sojourner on earth. He leaves home. He heads out on a dream based on a promise from a God he really doesn't know, a God he hasn't grown up with. There's no scripture he can go to learn about him. This is just a God who appears to him and makes promises, and he believes them. Abram and Sarah must wonder now, who will take care of them? Abram's already 75. Sarah's 65. They have no children. They're leaving their land, going to a place where they don't know the language and customs, where they have no relatives, nobody to protect them from the local population. This is a movement away from security into a strange and dangerous country. They would not have done it at all if they were looking for a comfortable life. Even in the promises that God makes, it's clear that he's calling them to live for others and not just for their own interests. And even considering the promise of land, what good is that if you have nobody to pass it on to? You will be a blessing, God says, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. They're called to be a blessing to this fragile world of many nations where nobody listens to each other, and yet they head off without a map, living in a tent, and never owning any property, except after Sarah dies, Abram buys a grave for her. According to Hebrews 11:13, all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. God says Abram, through Sarah, will be the father of a great nation. But he and Sarah wind up having just one son. And other than a few hints here and there, they see very little evidence in their lifetime that the promises of God will ever become a reality. Yet in this small way, God begins the salvation of the world through one family willing to trust him to make their name great, instead of trying to build something in order to make a great name of their own. And God led Abram to the crossroads of all civilization, where all nations could be impacted by his descendants. If you look at a map and you look where Canaan is, it's between the great civilizations to the north, to the west, to the east, and the great civilizations to the south. You have to pass through there. It's at a crossroads. And that's exactly what happened. All nations all over the world were impacted by Abram following God's call. But to understand the story of Shinar and the Tower of Babel and the story of the call of Abram, we need to see them together, just like they're written in the text, side by side in the biblical text, because these stories represent clearly divergent paths set before you and before me, and we're going to make a choice for ourselves. Are we going to follow the logic of Babel? Are we going to follow the logic of Abram? These stories present us with a fundamental choice of, on the one hand, living to build a great life for ourselves, a great name for ourselves, a great career, a great reputation. Or, on the other hand, to choose to follow God on an occasionally frightening and often surprising journey that results in blessings to others, trusting Him to make our life significant, to give us greatness. In New Testament terms, that's called a call to discipleship. God promises to make us great. He will lift us up if we will relinquish control of our dreams and visions, stop trying to become great on our own due to our own efforts and accomplishments, and instead follow Him in His vision for this world and for our personal lives. Now, this is not easy. Following God can be a frightening prospect because it means letting go of things that give us a sense of security and identity. It means walking by faith and not by sight. For Abraham, it meant leaving his own country, his kin, permanently, never going back. And living for God in our day may mean that we have to miss out on what the world would consider great opportunities. And that sounds scary. But God reminds us, if we listen to Him, that the most dangerous path we could choose is to follow our own plan for greatness. While on its face it looks like discipleship is the more frightening option, in reality, self-service is doomed to failure. As Proverbs 19:21 says, "Many are the plans in a man's heart, but the Lord's purpose prevails." Or Psalm 127, verse 1, "Unless the Lord builds the house, its builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stand guard in vain." You can choose the path and logic of Babel. You can choose to build a great career, a great home, a great name, a legacy for yourself. But if the Lord doesn't build that, your work is futile. As a wise man says, it's all just wind blowing. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 4 and following, "I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor. This was the reward for all my toil. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun." No matter what your plans are, it's the Lord's purpose that will prevail. We can't really live for personal security and reputation and follow God's call as disciples of Jesus, working for God's kingdom. And the choice between these two ways of life impacts how we view ourselves everywhere we go. For example, think of your workplace. Why are you there? How do you see yourself there? Do you go to this place every day to build something for yourself? Or do you go to this place to be God's presence and blessing there as an agent of God's peace, of reconciliation, of God's love? Do you go there as an agent of self-promotion? Are you conscious of what your presence in the workplace means for the others around you? Or are you just building a tower to secure your future, building a legacy for yourself, building a name for yourself? What about an education? When you make the effort to get an education, are you preparing yourself to serve others? Or are you just seeking to feather your own nest to increase your earning potential? Why work so hard to get an education? What is the point of it? Why did you choose to live in this city? Was it because of opportunities for building a name for yourself? Was it because this is the most comfortable, secure place for you? Do you feel called by God to be a blessing here? To serve the mission of God? How do you choose your neighborhood? Is there anything beyond self-interest in that decision where you choose to put down your roots? Why have children? Why do you decide to have children? Do you have children to make your life feel more complete? Do you have children so that you will feel loved? To make a lasting name for yourself? Or do we have children in order to share God's creative love with them and for them, in order to have an opportunity to give and to love the same reason God created you, and to teach them to embrace his call and become a blessing to the world? You know, Connie and I love having our children live near us during their adult years. It's wonderful, especially now that we're grandparents. You know, that's not something I've ever experienced before in my life. We have never lived by grandparents. From the time I was a little kid, we did not. Because we went where my dad felt called and had a place to serve and minister in churches. So we went wherever that took us, even if it took us to Africa. And yes, we had great relationships with my grandparents, but we knew there was something more important than being comfortable and being near family. Following God is more important. Jesus says, if you won't leave your family to serve me, then you're not really my disciple. And so we love having them around us, but it's more important to us that they listen to God's call to serve him by serving others, wherever that takes them, whether near or far. That's where we want them to be. That's the decision my parents made. That's the decision we've made, and we hope they will make the same choices. Now, we moved east of the Mississippi. never dreamed, and now we're here. Why do you attend this church or any particular church? Does it have to do with which church I believe fulfills the needs and desires of me and my family best? Is that what it's about? I come to this church because it does the most for me and my family? Or more cynically, do I choose a successful church for the same reasons that I jump on a team's bandwagon when they're winning? Because it appears successful and I want to be associated with that? Or, even more cynically, do I choose a church based on the networking potential there for furthering my career and making more money? Is that how I choose a church? Or do we attend worship and become part of a church because we believe it has adopted God's mission as its own and we want to be a part of what God is doing there? Or, as many of you have chosen, because it is your faith family and you're committed to it. This is your family, you're committed to it, and warts and all, you love it. And so you're committed to it. That's a great reason to be a part of a church. Do we choose a church because we want to exercise the gifts God has given us in service to a cause greater than ourselves? Not because we want to make a name for ourselves, but because we want to glorify God's name in service and worship. And why is this church here anyway? Is the Westport Road Church here to serve itself? Or to make a name for itself? Or to create some kind of lasting legacy and be seen as something great? Or is it here to serve, to minister to the desires of its members, or to train and equip its members to become ministers? What is the reason that we're here? What is our purpose as a church? And which of these priorities best reflects the logic of Babel, and which reflects the logic of Abram? Or should I say, which best reflects the name Church of Christ? See, God wants you to really be somebody. Somebody like Noah or Abraham or Samuel or Moses or David or Paul or Peter or any one of the hundreds of shining examples of people who chose to follow the logic of Abram rather than the logic of Babel. and God made their names great. They didn't achieve greatness for themselves and make a legacy that lasts for themselves. In fact, how many people's names do we remember from that time of history anyway? You see, we all give our life for something. We spend our life on something. We pour it out. We lose it. We give it away. We just more and more. Life's evening sun is sinking low. A few more days and I must go, and you too. So how do we choose to spend this life? We're going to spend it. What are we going to spend it on? That's the choice, the logic of Babel, the logic of Abram. Those people are great because when God called, they answered. We don't know the stories of those to whom God called and they said, no thanks, God. I wonder about this sometimes. I wonder whether or not it was Abram's father that was actually called and he only made it as far as Haran. I wonder who, you know, Samuel, here am I, you know, or Isaiah or Jeremiah, when God called and they answered, even if they were reluctant at first, or Moses. And I wonder if there are other people that lived at the same time whom God called who said no thanks and were not willing to follow the logic of Abram, and their names are forgotten. They built nothing, they accomplished nothing, they have no legacy because they said no thanks. I'm curious about it, but I don't know because it's not a story worth telling. That's your choice this morning. Be somebody. God is calling. Be somebody.